You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, opioid and heroin addiction are now considered an epidemic here in Wisconsin. We'll hear about stories of addiction and recovery from 10 people around the state being published as part of a new project. Now, a new sport is making its debut at the Winter Olympics in February, mixed doubles curling. It's a lot like team curling, except it's faster and only two people compete from each country. This year, Team USA is represented by siblings Becca and Matt Hamilton from McFarland. WPR's Maureen McCollum recently spoke with them at the Madison Curling Club, where they are training for the Winter Games. Those games start on February 8th.
So how did you catch the curling bug?
So I remember in eighth grade, I watched my dad do it, and I did not think it was cool when dad was doing it. And then I had a neighbor actually that tried it, and he brought me down to give it a whirl, and that's when I started to like get into the idea of it. And then my freshman year of high school, one of my good buddies asked me to play in a league with him on Thursdays, and I was hesitant, but he told me that after league, the team that's on bye will make dinner for all the teams that are playing, and that intrigued me because I'm always down for dinner, and it seemed like a good fit, and it was with a friend, and I just like fell in love with it. I loved the strategy, and that's what really like hooked me in, is like also being able to outsmart your opponent as well as outplay them.
Yeah, once I was drug out on the ice, I didn't look back. I was down here every single day before school, after school, playing in multiple leagues a night, and I was hooked.
And I think when you get older too, you start realizing the things that mom and dad did when you were younger are actually pretty fun.
That's true.
Yeah, I hate to say it, but that's absolutely true.
So why is it that you continue to curl? And for people who haven't tried it, what's that feeling like when you're out on the ice?
One of the things that really hooked me was like the games are great and you love competing and playing, but when I came down here and I was alone in this curling club and you're just throwing stones for practice and you're the only one out there, it's almost poetic. Like, there's all you can hear is like your broom sliding on the ice and the rocks sliding and, you know, the occasional sound of rocks hitting each other. And it's kind of serene. It was almost like it was very zen to come down here and like spend some time by yourself and kind of be in your own mind, and you maybe play one on one against yourself, and it's, you can still like have the strategy of the game, but the silence and the just the flow of everything was really peaceful, and I really enjoyed that part of it growing up and learning how to play.
So can you talk about your communication strategy with each other? I'm assuming since you're siblings, that communication style could be a bit different than it is, say, with your other teammates?
We kind of have a different
dynamic
out on the ice than I do with my women's team. Matt and I feed off each other, and we ground each other at the same time. So he's pretty involved in the crowd, and he's got an upbeat personality. And I'm kind of the calm out there that reels him back in when he needs to. And he helps me be lighthearted when I need to as well. So I think that we balance each other out well. And then when we are throwing our rocks, he taught me how to curl, basically. And I grew up playing with him. So he can tell immediately if I do something wrong with a shot. And we're able to work those out right away. I can just fix it. And it's pretty awesome playing with Matt and being able to, I guess, have that chemistry that we've worked so hard for our entire lives and take it out on the ice, and then now to take it to the Olympic level, it's going to be a surreal experience.
It's really fun to listen to the way that the two of you banter back and forth with each other.
Yeah, I think part of our success has come from like being so comfortable with my sister. We have fun, we can loosen up for, you know, between shots and when we think it's appropriate, but at the same time, like, if someone's struggling or something like that, we can tell each other with absolute honesty what we're seeing. So it's really easy to like get back on track because there's never going to be any like animosity or doubt in each other, because she knows like I'm just trying to help and she's just trying to help. So
Matt, what are Becca's strengths as a curler?
Becca has some like laser focus when she throws. That is a very obvious in her face, but it's impressive, and I think aside from that laser focus, her biggest strength is sweeping. She's, in my opinion, the best female sweeper in the United States, so I think I have a huge advantage.
So what does it take to be such a phenomenal sweeper?
I actually have kind of a different style of sweeping that not very many people in the U.S. do. And so I actually lock the broom in my arm, and then by doing that, I'm able to put all my weight on the brush.
I'd never watched mixed doubles before I watched the two of you compete, and it seems absolutely exhausting.
It's constantly moving. We're sliding from end to end, and then we have to run back and then throw our shot because we're being timed. If we run out of time, it's an automatic forfeit. So, yeah, it's fast-paced, but I think that's why Matt and I kind of found like our niche in it. And so it's working well for us. We're fast thinkers, and we're able to, I guess, get the win.
So, Becca, what are Matt's strengths as a curler?
You know, Matt brings just a different type of energy out in the ice that I've never seen like on any team. And the way he makes me feel relaxed helps, I guess, me play better. And, I mean, he's confident he can make any shot. And with that confidence, I let him throw whatever he wants. And we make it. Because, I mean, with the sweeping and then his such precise shooting, it's really fun to play with him. And I'm very fortunate to do so.
So this is the first year mixed doubles has been in the Olympics, correct?
Yes.
Yes.
You guys are trailblazers.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting. About 4 years ago, they announced that it was going to be an Olympic sport, and that's when me and Becca kind of metaphorically stood back and looked at each other and were like, yeah, this is something we got to do because the brother-sister thing, we're going to have an advantage as far as what we know about each other and how we play. So, it was kind of a no-brainer.
What does it feel like going to the Olympics?
I think finally it's starting to hit us. We've had some really cool opportunities around the Jimmy Fallon show.
What? I missed that.
Well, yeah, we were on the Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon and Jason Sudeikis.
Please give a warm Tonight Show welcome to U.S. Olympic curling team superstars and real-life siblings, Becca and Matt Hamilton, ladies and gentlemen. Honored to have you here. That's Jason Sudeikis. Welcome to the show.
Guys, your musical is amazing.
No.
Thank you. I wrote it myself.
These are Olympians. These are
different Hamiltons.
It's different
gotcha.
Hamiltons. They were
haven't
in
seen
that
it.
Hamilton.
So with these different opportunities that we've been given, like we've been sponsored by Cheetos and we've been sponsored by Kemp's Milk.
So when you get sponsored, does that help you afford to go over there, and does it get you a little bit of money too?
We have to work as well, so when we're missing a month of work to be at the Olympics, that helps, I guess, just get by on a day-to-day basis. For a lot of curlers from different countries, this is their job, so they get a salary to curl, where we don't get that yet in the U.S. So
that would be just dreamy. I can't tell you how many times I'll go and work 8 hours at work, and then I'll come home and, like, man, I got, like, an hour and a half workout that I need to do. And it's just hard to, like, motivate yourself sometimes.
It's like two full-time jobs.
It can be. I know last year I was on the road for 110 days, and Becca is probably right up there with me. So that's a heck of a lot of curling and a lot of time spent away from home. So, yeah, every dollar we can get is going to the right place because we spend a lot of time training and trying to get there.
That was WPR's Maureen McCollum talking with Becca and Matt Hamilton, a sister and brother duo from McFarland, who are headed to the Winter Olympics next month to compete in mixed doubles curling. New project shares the experiences of 10 Wisconsinites who are recovering from heroin addiction. USA Today's Hooked in Wisconsin series features stories and interviews with people from all over the state. Their stories of the road to addiction and recovery are all different, but they all hope that sharing their experiences can prevent others from getting addicted. Alexandra Wimley is a photographer and video storyteller for USA Today Network Wisconsin. She worked extensively on this project. Allie, welcome to Central Time. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, talk about the origins of this project, tracking down these stories of people dealing with heroin and recovery.
Yeah, so this project was pitched in late September by one of our reporters. And it sort of started off as a way to explore this issue of addiction by interviewing people about their very first time ever using heroin. It sort of morphed from there to become something a little more broad, because we realized that having such a narrow focus didn't really catch all the important details of these people's stories. But from that original idea, we got our sort of team from all over the state. We have 11 sites across the state of Wisconsin. And so we were able to sort of tap into those resources to get a huge range of people from different communities all across the state to tell their stories and to allow the reporters and I sort of into their lives to get a glimpse of what their lives look now that they've been clean for a little while and how their lives have been affected by addiction.
And people were willing to talk under their own names with their pictures featured prominently. People were willing to talk about this very difficult story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it obviously did take some time. There were some people we reached out to who weren't willing to participate in the story. But everyone who did agree to it, I was actually surprised to find were very willing and excited to be a part of it. And I think that really speaks to the fact that many of these people have truly lost everything due to this one substance, you know, their families, their lives, their jobs, and everyone has sort of expressed this interest to do anything that they can to make sure that other people don't end up in their same position. And, you know, sharing their stories is a big part of doing that. And I think it's really interesting that everyone is so willing to do it, you know, share these intimate details about their lives in order to prevent other people from getting sort of trapped into the cycle of addiction.
Everybody had their own story, and they're all different, but there were common themes. One of those themes was prescription pain pills as kind of a starting point, at least for many people. I want to take a listen to Rebecca Palmieri of Wisconsin Rapids talking about how she became addicted to heroin.
For 5 months after I had my son, they just kept prescribing pain meds. Once they did corrective surgery, by then I was hooked. And when I came here, I met somebody that just immediately introduced me to heroin. So he said, give me your arm. And I just gave him my arm in my bedroom, and like, it was instant. It got to the point where, you know, when I lost everything, I didn't even care. It was no big deal. It steals your soul.
We've heard from our listeners on the show. We've talked to guests. You talked to a lot of people who had this story. The first step toward opioid addiction wasn't the heroin itself. It was pain pills, whether prescribed to them or obtained in another way. Is that something you saw a lot?
Yeah, I mean, that was pretty much the common thread through it all. I mean, no one just starts with heroin, you know. And something that I heard over and over again was, also sort of people have this image in their head that a heroin addict is always shooting it up. But people just start by taking it, whether it be snorting it or in pill form as an opiate, which seems to a lot of people like you're not crossing that same line. But it always ends up where, you know, that is not the same high, or it's not the same high that they're looking for. And that's when they sort of cross line after line after line. They don't realize how bad it's getting until it's almost too late. So it does sort of start with those painkillers, and then it progresses from there.
Yeah, watching and the photo series and listening to people talk about it, that is such a common thing, as you said, crossing lines. I'll do this, but I'm not doing that, so it's not that bad. I'm not going to do that. And finally, the last one always seemed to be, okay, well, I'm not using it in needle form. And then I think in all these cases, people ended up there.
Right. And, I mean, you know, it usually comes down to price. You know, people can't afford these painkillers that they got addicted to, whether it be prescribing it because of a medical issue or just using them recreationally. And then they can't find it, they can't afford it, and heroin's cheaper and it gets you that same high quicker. And so people just move on to that once the addiction reaches that point.
I want to listen to another story. This is Kyle Ketting of Wisconsin Rapids, a heavy, he said, heroin user until a fatal incident made him commit to recovery. Here's some of that story.
It had gotten to the point where I just, life sucked. Every day sucked. You know, looking in the mirror, I didn't want to be here anymore. That progressed until December 2nd, 2014, where me and a bunch of my friends were getting high, and then one person ended up dying as a result of our drug use. The next morning, the detectives were at my door. At that point, I knew I could not keep living my life the way I was living it, because that's gonna be me. I had to do everything I could to change everything about me. The only thing I can do to try to make amends to that person is by living a clean and sober life today.
So Kyle's legal story is getting on, but can you talk about Kyle and other people trying to recover? Were there a lot of cases where they hit the catchphrase is they hit bottom? Did that happen a lot?
Yes, I mean, you know, sometimes it was more of just a cycle of sort of trying to get clean, and not because of such like a rock bottom, but more, you know that it's unhealthy and they want to get clean and they relapse a few times. But there are definitely circumstances where it was an incarceration or something like that, that was that rock bottom that forced people into recovery.
We're talking to Alexandra Wimley from USA Today Network Wisconsin about the Hooked in Wisconsin series looking at people's roads to heroin addiction and then recovery. People around the state. I want to listen to another one now. Jody Paulus, one of the people you talked with, a member of the United Nation. He said spirituality and something called the Grandpa Fire helped him recover. Here's some of his story.
I chose heroin. It was kind of like when I first came across, it was like, I got what I was looking for. Nothing bothers you. You know, you feel complete. I got locked up. And when I got locked up, I got locked up for 9 months. With those 4 months, I had to go in the hole. Solitary confinement, you know, no communication whatsoever, nothing. The best thing that ever happened to me is when I got locked up. I knew something was missing. But it boiled down to my spirituality through our ways. And once I went there, I did a whole 180 turn to where I stayed strong, and I devoted myself to this fire, devoted myself to our culture. Actually, getting clean was the easiest part, but staying strong is the hardest part. You're leaving behind that bond that you had with your friends or whoever it is that you're hanging out with, you know. But now I can't say anything about it because they're all dead now.
Alexandra, I hear again and again in these stories as people talk about recovery, they don't talk about methadone. They don't talk about replacement drugs. Well, maybe they talk to you about that too. But again and again, it's the social connections, changing who they associated with in their life, change their cultural setting, their spiritual setting. It's more than just getting clean of the drugs. It's changing their lives, it sounds like.
Yeah, a common thread that I saw is that most of these people replaced the drug use with something. So, you know, for Joey, it was this fire where him and other recovering addicts spend a majority of their day there. And it's sort of the cultural connection, it's the social connection, it's the support where there are other recovering addicts who they can go to and say, you know, today I really want to use, but I'm not going to, and I'm going to sit here all night if I have to. And that'll distract me from this urge. You know, for other people, for another one of our subjects, it was a volleyball league that he does with other members of Narcotics Anonymous. You know, another person cleans up the parks with his son and just, you know, picks up trash and mows lawns and has this whole sort of movement around that. So there's always sort of something else that fills that gap that used to just be the drug use.
As you talk to people, was there a sense that, okay, I am recovered? Or was there a sense that they're still working, that there's that worry that they might backslide?
You know, we did sort of, it's a wide range of these individuals. You know, some have only been clean for a few months, some for a few years. But there's sort of this old, there's always this thing that there's the possibility that, you know, you're never fully recovered once you sort of know what this addiction feels like. You always kind of want to use. But what I heard from multiple of these people is they know the effect it has on their life, and that's strong enough force to keep them from going back. But it is always something that they have to maintain. They have to make sure that their mental health is in control so that they can, you know, maintain their recovery and continue to get support for it, probably for the rest of their lives.
A part of your goal and part of the goal of the people talking to you was to put a human face on this issue of addiction. Here's a quick listen to Moria Rogowski of Green Bay.
A lot of people think people who use are like, you know, they're garbage. They're not good, they're worthless, or like they're just bad people in general. They're not. Not at all.
Can you talk about her story and putting that human face on what we think of as statistics sometimes?
Yeah, I mean, you know, her story is special because she grew up in, you know, a nice, like, normal family. She had a normal childhood, and she just fell into drug use because that's what her friends were doing. And now there's sort of this stigma surrounding her because she has at one point been a heroin addict. And she especially wants to go to school to become a recovery coach because she understands addiction better than someone who's never been through it. And she wants to help people who are in her position.
And one more theme that came up for at least some of the people was a history as children in many cases of some kind of abuse or neglect. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, one thing I heard over and over is just the numbing effect of drugs. So, you know, someone who has faced abuse in their childhood turned to alcohol and softer drugs that, you know, as young teenagers to sort of numb that abuse. And then they never really learn how to cope with it, and they need something to sort of self-medicate as they become young adults, and that's when they turn to opiates and then heroin. That seems to be a common thread through some of these individuals.
And are you going to be following up, moving forward, to doing more projects like this with recovering addicts in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so the team has a plan in 2018 to dive deeper into certain aspects of heroin in Wisconsin, whether it be the methadone program or, you know, where the heroin actually comes from, things like that, sort of deeper dives into some of the issues that we touched on in these profiles. And some of these individuals, we will use as sources for these stories while finding, you know, new people and experts who can speak on it. So this is sort of the launching point of a wider series we plan to do in the coming year.
We'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That's Alexandra Wimley, photographer and video storyteller for USA Today Network Wisconsin. She was with us to talk about the project Hooked in Wisconsin, When Heroin Hits Home. First, in his annual State of the State address yesterday, Governor Scott Walker painted a very positive view of Wisconsin, calling the state historically strong and making the case for his economic achievements.
In Wisconsin, employment is at historic highs and unemployment is at historic lows. We invested more actual dollars into schools than ever before in our history. The state property tax is gone. Wisconsin received a bond rating upgrade from three national agencies. Our healthcare systems are ranked number one in the nation for quality. And we announced the largest economic development project in state history. It has been an amazing year, a historic year.
While the speech covered a lot of ground, the story of the state's continued economic recovery was a major theme. As you heard, Walker referred to record high employment, record low unemployment, and the upcoming Foxconn project. But is Wisconsin's economy as strong as the governor suggests? Ask one of the many Democrats running for governor, three of them in the room there. They might give you a different response. We've asked two economists to join us today to weigh in and break down some of what the governor had to say. Stephen Deller is a professor of agricultural and applied economics and the interim director for the Center for Community and Economic Development at the UW-Madison and UW Extension. Steve, welcome back to the show.
Good afternoon.
And we're also joined by Noah Williams, director of the Center for Research on the Wisconsin Economy. He's the Julie Plant Granger Professor of Economics at UW-Madison. Noah, welcome back to you.
Great. Thanks. Happy to be here.
Well, Noah, let's start with you. How do you assess the economy of Wisconsin? Is the governor on target with his positive remarks there?
I think in broad outline, yes, he is. He is on target. We do have historically low unemployment rates. 3% unemployment, which has only been reached at one time previously in our history since these statistics have been compiled. We've seen an acceleration of growth recently, really throughout the whole recovery from the recession from, you know, roughly 2010 onward. We've seen steady growth, and this has continued and really led to improvements in the state.
And Steve, how about you? What's your assessment of the state's economy?
I think technically what the governor said is correct. We are above where we were. So we are at historic employment levels. We're at historic unemployment rates. But if you look at us, how we have recovered from the Great Recession compared to the nation, we would be doing even better if we had kept up with the rest of the country.
Noah, do you buy that? Are we lagging the rest of the country in this recovery?
So we are lagging the rest of the country only to the extent that you look at measures of sort of overall economic activity, not adjusting for population. So the reason these figures are lower than nationally is because we've had low population and labor force growth. So if you're more interested in things like living standards, we're actually doing relatively well.
Living standards and wages, Steve, how are we looking lately?
Actually, we've got a problem, but this is a national problem, and Wisconsin is experiencing this as well, is that we've got a widening income gap. If you look at the Department of Workforce Development's occupational forecast, you look at the top 25 growing occupations, the vast majority of them require less than a high school education, and that translates into low-paying wages. So if you look at the employment growth numbers, we're kind of lagging behind the nation, but yet we are above where we, the Great Recession. But a lot of those jobs that are being generated are pretty low-paying jobs.
I want to look at the benchmark the governor referred to, improvements from 8 years ago. And it's a political year, so the governor is going to say some of the credit goes to the policies he's brought into place since 2011. But that was a low point. That was kind of bottoming out in the Great Recession there. How much, Noah, can we credit these pretty good numbers for the most part to state policy versus participating in a national recovery?
Well, certainly that's a difficult thing to tease out. I think what has been clear is that there was a change in emphasis on economic growth and economic activity, you know, Wisconsin being open for business when the Walker administration began. I think some of the policies which the governor has implemented, some of the tax reform, some of the business incentives, and there's really been a focus on keeping property taxes particularly low. I think those have all helped to contribute.
And Steve, same basic question, how much of the Wisconsin recovery is Wisconsin charting its own path versus riding a national slow recovery wave?
I think it's mostly following the national trend. If you look at the Wisconsin economy, we've really kind of got two types of industries, those that are driven primarily on trying to keep their costs down as low as possible, and those that kind of are driven on innovation. And I think the governor's policies and the Republican Party's policies have really been favoring those that focus on keeping the cost of production down. So in that regard, those policies are positive, but is that the future of the state's economy? I think the future is on innovation. And those policies are not what are being enacted right now.
No, what do you think about that, innovation versus the keep the cost down model?
I'm not quite sure I would characterize things quite the same way. There has been an emphasis on innovation through investment as well. Investment credits for startup of new businesses, all of which contribute to increasing development in the state. Nonetheless, there is sort of a historic, you know, legacy industry which has had slower productivity growth, and the outlook for some of those certainly would not be as strong. But nonetheless, there are pockets, and I would say a growing component of more new economy, higher productivity industries which have developed.
Talking to Steve Deller and Noah Williams, Wisconsin economists, looking at the state of Wisconsin's economy after Governor Walker's State of the State address and in an election year. You can join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Noah, you mentioned pockets there. I've seen some people, including Madison Mayer and one of many Democratic candidates for governor, Paul Sogland, saying Madison's economy, Dane County area's economy, is doing great. That's driving a lot of good news we're seeing around Wisconsin. Do you think he has that right?
So it's clear that Madison is doing well, and that's been an important contributor to the state's overall economic activity. But I think it's not Madison solely. We've seen growth throughout all corners of the state. We've seen development of a smaller but burgeoning tech sector in Eau Claire, for instance. In addition, a lot of there's been substantial growth in finance and in insurance in the Milwaukee area. So Madison is important, but I don't think it's the sole driver of the state.
And Steve, can you talk about the distribution of good news in Wisconsin's economy?
I agree with Noah that there are some pockets that are doing quite well. There's Eau Claire that's trying to rejuvenate itself, and it's trying to emulate some of the success that Madison's been having. But depending on you know, which time period you look at. You know, you look at before the Great Recession, the bottom, or right at the tail end. Most of the job growth, about three quarters, has been coming out of the Madison, kind of the metropolitan area, not just the city of Madison, but kind of the surrounding area. But that doesn't mean that there aren't other pockets. The Fox Valley area has seen some growth. Eau Claire's seen some growth. La Crosse has seen some growth. So there are other pockets. But again, a lot of it is coming out of the Madison area.
I want to get into not just assessing what the governor had to say, but some of his ideas for the future, things he's hoping can get passed probably in the next few months by the legislature. One of the things he just unveiled, this idea of a child tax credit, about $122 million. $100 per kid credit. Is this something you see benefiting the economy? Is it a good bang for our buck in Wisconsin, Noah?
Well, I think it would certainly be positive, but a credit of that size is not going to have a major impact. I think the impact would be felt more distributionally, in the sense that for lower income households, even though $100 per child may not seem like much for a lower income household, that could be actually a substantial portion of the amount of taxes they pay. And moreover, this is it's a refundable credit as well, so it could contribute to checks back to
right.
households.
To be clear, it's not a tax deduction that wouldn't help people who aren't. Who are at lower incomes, right? This is
That's
a credit,
right.
No matter how much you make.
Yes, it's a credit, and it's refundable in the sense that if your tax bill would be less than $100, you get a check back from the state.
And Steve, what do you think of that as a policy? I mean, people make the case that something like that $100, especially for the lower income people receiving it, that's pumped right back into the economy.
I think that's true, but $100 is not very much. But if you're in the low income area, I mean, $100 can't really matter. But I think where that money's coming from, I think, is more important. I think from a fiscal perspective, the state should really be using that surplus to really be doing two things. One is buying back debt, is paying off some of our credit cards, and the other is putting some of it away in a rainy day fund. I think giving out these small tax credits really is not the most fiscally conservative use of that money.
And Noah, what do you think of that idea of what to do with this surplus?
So in general, I mean, I would rather see across the board rate reductions, but for a credit of this size, I think it could have some impact, but again, it would be rather limited given the scope of it.
We're talking right now with economists Noah Williams and Stephen Deller, both from UW-Madison and UW Extension for Steve. We're looking at the state of Wisconsin's economy. Governor Walker says we're historically strong. Democrats are taking issue with some of that in a big election year. 800-642-1234 is the number where you can weigh in and ask your questions for our guests. Does Wisconsin's economy deserve the high marks Governor Walker gave it in his State of the State address? If it does, is it because of Governor Walker's policies and his and the Republicans in the legislature? Where do you think Wisconsin's economy could be improved? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. Let's bring on a caller now. Gwen is on the line in Madison. Gwen, hi.
Hello. I just wanted to make the comment that GDP has nothing to do with how well the average worker is doing, because the companies are not raising wages. Wages have been stagnant. And so basically, you know, if you look at how the average worker is doing, we're not doing well. I'm earning $15,000 a year less than I was 8 years ago because of things that happened with my job was eliminated in the economy, and I had to take a job that paid a lot less.
Gwen, I'm going to jump in because I want to give our guest time to respond. Thank you for calling, and I'm sorry about that. Good luck to you. Noah, what do you say to Gwen? Maybe the state's more productive. The economy is looking good. It may not look like that to a lot of workers.
So certainly, on average, GDP does track wages and incomes over the long run, but certainly there's a distribution associated with that. So it's unfortunate that the callers had hard times, but nonetheless, when we do see GDP grow, and we actually have seen a pickup recently that does tend to be associated with average wage increases, although there is quite a bit of heterogeneity in that.
Meaning maybe there's a lot of some people up at the top, their wages are going up, and people at the bottom, maybe in those lower skilled jobs that Steve was talking about, not.
Exactly. Yeah. Sorry, not to get too technical. Yes. Around that average, there's quite a bit of different experiences people face.
Yeah. Steve, your thoughts.
I think if you can, if I can borrow Kathy Kramer's The Politics of Resentment, I think part of what's happening here was brought up by Gwen is that before the Great Recession, they may have had a $50,000 a year job as an accountant or something. And after the Great Recession, the best they can do is $25,000 as a fast food manager. And I think people are frustrated by that. And I think that's part of this widening income gap that we're talking about. The other thing about wages being stagnant is that a lot of employers are maybe not increasing wages, but they're trying to keep cost of benefits down to the employer. So employers are trying to compensate a little bit more, and it's not being picked up in some of those wage numbers.
But I want to throw this at both of you. The things both of you just said, that's not a Wisconsin story or a Wisconsin-only story, right? These are things we're talking about all over the country.
No, that's definitely true. Yeah,
that's right.
We'll bring on another caller. Gwen, thanks for calling in. We'll go next to Bill on the line in Greendale. Bill, hi.
Hi, great conversation.
Thanks.
I had to call. I heard one of the guests talk about every corner of Wisconsin, and I can't quote the rest of it, but you need to know that there's a lot of, I work in Racine, there's a lot of unemployment, and I know you weren't addressing that particularly, and I appreciate that there's so much good happening in Wisconsin, but I just think that needs to be, held up there too. I just want to bring that out a little bit, and also I just want to comment on this idea of a surplus. When I'm driving the roads I'm driving, when I'm teaching in the schools I'm teaching in, it shouldn't be that hard for us to come up with money for good roads and good schools. I don't see that surplus in reality.
Bill, thanks a lot for the call. Well, a lot potentially to get into there. First, Bill saying, hey, we've got pockets where the economy is really not looking so good. How can state policy tackle that? Let's start with Steve.
I think that a lot of it is up to local communities to take a more proactive role. The state can really only do so much. The state kind of sets the rules of the game. The state can be a major player in major employment decisions, say a Foxconn. But a lot of responsibility falls down to local communities to kind of take more of a proactive role in terms of addressing some of these issues.
Noah?
No, I would agree with that. In addition, since the caller brought up Racine, I did want to mention that I'd looked at some of the data recently looking at not just the state unemployment rate, but in different communities across the state. And Racine did have one of the higher unemployment rates. But nonetheless, even there, they've seen the unemployment rate fall by a significant amount recently.
Thanks a lot for that call, Bill. I want to mention another initiative the governor was talking about, the idea of a rural economic development fund, about $50 million a year, aimed at development of new businesses and expansion of small businesses in rural Wisconsin. Steve, you said it's up to the locals a lot, but is this something that the state can do that can make a difference, especially in rural areas that may not be seeing the economic recovery as well?
I applaud that. I'd like to see the details, but in a general concept, I think that's I like the idea. But a lot of it's going to, how is this actually play out? The one thing that I will say is that over the past year or so, the governor and the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation has really started to kind of embrace this idea of small business development, business retention and expansion of existing businesses. It's a slow shift. I think it's a positive shift, and I think this might be a reflection of that shift, which I applaud.
And I know you, Steve, are a big fan of focusing on the newer businesses, the smaller businesses. What do you think of that, Noah? Is that a good place for the state to focus?
No, certainly. Much of the growth, not just in the state, but nationwide, comes from small business. So anything we can do to help that and generate more small business startups would be great.
Let's bring up another caller now. We've got Wyatt in Hazel Green. Wyatt, hi.
Yes, hello.
What do you want to bring up, Wyatt?
Yeah, I'd like to know if it's available, like the recent reports, what is like the average household debt in Wisconsin? And, how would that affect us? How is it compared to like the past? and what kind of like resiliency that kind of sets us up for any kind of downturns.
Wyatt, thanks a lot for bringing that up. An important part of the economy. I don't know if you guys have that in front of you right now, but in general terms, Steve, you want to give a go?
Noah and I just both looked at each other and went, wow, that's a good question.
I want specific numbers down to five decimal points, you guys.
You could look at maybe the foreclosure data, because I think that's a good measure of debt to income, is whether or not you can maintain your house. And the foreclosure rates have really been dropping down significantly. There are still some pockets in the state where it's a bit of a concern, but if that's one indicator, we're doing much better.
How about household debt as an indicator, even if we don't have the numbers right in front of us, Noah?
Excuse me?
Debt as an indicator of how our economy is doing.
So if we look, certainly in the recession, the increase in household debt was a main contributor to that. Wisconsin just didn't see the wide swings in debt finance and mortgage problems that we saw in the rest of the country.
Right, we never hit the point of a lot of other states in foreclosures. Do I have that right?
Not even close. We were much more. That's right. I'll leave it at that.
Well, I want to start looking forward into our future. You guys have both touched briefly on Foxconn. Let's get into that a little bit. Now the governor highlighted that, of course, in the speech yesterday. Noah, can you talk about the state's investment briefly and what it could mean for Wisconsin?
Yeah, the state has made a major investment in Foxconn. I did a report on this earlier this summer, looking at the impact of this. And essentially what I found was for every dollar that the state invested, just measuring the direct impact of jobs generated at Foxconn, we're looking at getting basically $4 back in labor income. Once you factor in additional spillovers, new investments, other opportunities, it could extend far beyond that. But of course, there's a lot of uncertainty about whether all that will come to pass. But
and Steve, I asked a big question with not much time. Briefly, your hopes and fears for Foxconn.
Half the jobs are going to go to people in Illinois, which is going to cut that impact in half.
Noah's shaking his head.
Disagree.
He's saying, well, we can argue about that, but we don't have the time for it. I think the other big loss is they just announced that the general contractor is coming out of Rhode Island. So that's a big chunk of money that's not going to be coming into staying in the state.
We'll have to leave it there for now, but we can bring you back maybe for a Foxconn show sometime. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Noah, thanks for coming up.
Thank you.
Stephen Deller is a professor of agriculture and applied economics and the interim director for the Center for Community and Economic Development at the UW-Madison and UW Extension. Noah Williams, also with us, director of the Center for Research on the Wisconsin Economy. He's the Julie Plant Granger Professor of Economics at UW-Madison. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll find out why Wisconsin tribes are taking the federal government to court over mining issues. New federal guidelines could change the way tips are handled by employers. We'll get the details. And by the way, you can share your thoughts on tipping and how it works where you work at 833-424-3327. Plus Food Friday, we're going to find out how to make the most out of the spices in our cooking. That and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time.